move to the second case this morning, Wim and Meekum versus Rojas Pension Fund.
Yes, they did.
they knew what.
I was just going to suggest that that might happen. That's like the dribble cup.
Good morning. Alice Ballard for the early retiree objectors in this case. We are appealing from the district court's entry of an order approving a class action settlement to which we had objected. And we're asking the court to reverse that order and remand the case to the district court for further proceedings with the early retirees separately certified as a subclass with independent counsel. Your Honor, you have ruled, the bench has ruled in this case, that COLA is an accrued benefit and that it must be afforded to lump sum retirees as long as it is given to annuitants in a pension plan, and it can't be cut back. The law also says that an early retirement subsidy, which is something our clients have, must be treated as an accrued benefit under ERISA and may not be cut back. The parties structured their settlement in this case on the premise that the early retirement subsidy could be used to reduce and indeed wipe out the COLA. The one accrued benefit could be used to wipe out the second accrued benefit, the COLA, in a way that would defeat the award of any remedy in the case to the early retirees. That was the premise. And the issue in this case is whether the district court erred in approving this settlement without ever examining the merits, the strength of the merits of that premise, and without looking at what that premise cost the early retirees. Now, in December of 2009, when the notice of the class settlement went out, we got calls from early retirees who said, we're looking at this, we don't quite get it, but we can see that the regular retirees are getting full value for their COLAs out of this settlement. And we're getting 3.5% of our lump sum. And the class notice says we're going to be getting less. Generally speaking, we're going to be getting less than the regular retirees. Doesn't say how much less. The only explanation as to why is that we got some sort of early retirement subsidy, which is a new word, and that it was greater than the COLA, and therefore the pension plan has already paid us more than what it owes us, so they don't have to pay us the COLA. That's essentially what the class notice said, was there is a significant material risk of you recovering nothing. So what they're asking us is, how much less are we actually getting? Why are we actually getting less? And is this fair? So we went after the first question, how much less are they getting? We hired an actuary, Ray Lee, and he calculated two numbers, used some of the retirement documents that some of our clients had retained. And he first calculated how much would the early retirees get if they just got their COLA the same way the regular retirees were getting. And then he compared that to what these people are actually getting under the settlement, their 3.5%. And he answered the question, how much less are they getting, with this big number, 80% less. They're getting 20% under the settlement of the full value of their COLA, when the regular retirees are getting full value for their COLAs. So then we looked at the why. Why are they getting less? We looked at the plan. We looked at the statute. We looked at the case law. And we thought, these guys have a pretty good argument for why they should get full value for their COLAs. It doesn't look to us like this is a 20% loser. And we looked at class counsel's briefs on this issue, and they were really good. They were very persuasive. We thought, these briefs don't sound like something that a lawyer would write who thinks this issue is a loser. And so we entered our objections. We went to the fairness hearing. We had submitted our actuary's report showing this steep cut for the early retirees. We presented all the arguments to the court. And at the fairness hearing, a couple of things happened. First of all, class counsel essentially agreed with us that the early retirees were taking a big cut. Class counsel's estimate was that it was somewhere between a third and a quarter that they were getting of full value on their case. And this was something that was not in the class notice and had never before been presented to the court. And then at the very end of the fairness hearing, it also came out at the judge's request that the home run value of the whole case, regular retirees and early retirees, was as high as $450 million. Class counsel estimated it at between $330 million and $450 million. The case was settling for $180 million, less than, you know, half of the home run value. And this is a case that basically the class had won at this level, and the plan had petitioned for cert, and the cert petition had been denied. So why is the case settling for half of the home run value? Well, the answer is it's because of this heavy, heavy discount off of the early retirees' recovery. The early retirees' component of the settlement was basically worth about $60,000. And the home run value of their claim alone was like $300,000. So that $240,000, that's what went out the window off the home run value of the whole case. And that's what enabled the plaintiffs to settle. So at the end of the fairness hearing, the judge had everything she needed to do what she was supposed to do. She had a stipulated record. She had our actuary's affidavit, which had not been refuted by any evidence in the record. She had the arguments in favor of the early retirees recovering full value on their claim, and she knew what they were being offered in comparison to what the home run value of their claim was. She was in a position to do what the cases say she was supposed to do, which was evaluate the merits of the early retirees' claim for full value and balance that against what they were being offered. And doing that exercise, she, under the law, should only decide that this settlement was fair if the early retirees' claim to full value only had a 20% chance of winning, because they were only getting 20% of the value of their claim. She didn't do that analysis. She punted on that analysis. If you look at the district court's opinion.
I like you have a baseball and a football. And
so I do, Your Honor.
Home runs and touchdowns.
I do. I'll go back to ballpark. Sinfields and GM talks about she had a duty to ballpark. Is that right? Anyway, to estimate the merits of the value of the claim versus what's being offered in light of how strong are the merits of the early retiree's claim to full value. If you look at page 11 of the volume 1 of the appendix, you can see what the judge said. She said, looking at the fairness of the settlement is more a matter of art than mathematics, and I see no reason not to accept the recommendations of counsel in this case. They're good lawyers. They worked hard to settle the case. She didn't cite one case on the merits of the early retirees' claim. She did not refer to the fact that the early retirees were getting such a steep discount off of the value of their claim. She basically just didn't do what she was supposed to do under Sinfuel, under General Motors. If she had done it, she would have seen that the early retirees had a very strong case on many levels. The summary plan description for this plan says, here are your benefits. There will be no offsets except under some limited circumstances, foreign pensions, pensions from other related companies. There aren't going to be any offsets. Essentially, what the settlement does in this case is offset their early retirement subsidy against their COLA. The SPD says no offsets. The plan itself says your early retirement benefit is your accrued benefit, which this court has now said includes the COLA. It's going to be your accrued benefit moved up a couple of years in time. In other words, you get your age 65 accrued benefit, but you get it when you're 62. Or if you take it earlier, it has some actuarial reductions. You get it early. All right, they get their accrued benefit, they get it early. The accrued benefit this court has defined as including the COLA, and that's what they get early. So the plan is now clear. They're entitled to their COLA and their subsidy. Their subsidy is simply the fact of moving their accrued benefit up. From age 65 to age 62. That's what the plan says. The statute says the COLA is an accrued benefit, and the early retirement subsidy has to be treated as an accrued benefit. So you have two accrued benefits. There's nothing in the statute that says if you get one, you don't have to get the other. And then we have the case law. There are two cases that are very, very close to this one. Cosentino and Lorenzano. If you look at the minimum level accrued benefit, let's put it here, under the statute, there are three factors that can affect that and say that the retirees are getting more or less than that. One is the COLA, one is the early retirement subsidy, and one is the interest rate that the plan uses to discount the annuity to present value, to the lump sum present value. In Lorenzano, the plan was under the minimum with regard to its COLA, the same way as was true in this case. So the COLA was, they were below the line on the COLA, but the employees had a, quote, subsidy on the interest factor because the plan was using a better factor than it had to under the law. The court ordered them to pay the COLA. They said, okay, but we're going to get credit for this extra interest that they're getting, this extra subsidy they're getting as a result of us using a more favorable interest rate than we had to use. So they wanted to do this. And the court said, you can't do that. We ordered you to pay the COLA. We didn't say you could take it out of the interest subsidy. In Cosentino, you had the interest was too low. The interest subsidy, what the interest rate they were using resulted in the employees getting less than they should under the statute, but they had an early retirement subsidy the way we do.
You realize you're going into your rebuttal time, don't you?
Oh, thank you, Judge. I didn't realize that. I very much appreciate it. And so I will stop.
Thank you, Counsel. Mr. Rocha?
Thank you, Judges. Robert LaRocca. I'm arguing the appeal in 3713 on the counsel fee issue. When awarding fees in a class action, The judge is the only fiduciary that the class has at that point because the class counsel's role changes to an adversarial role. And as many cases from this court have recognized, it's very important that the judge scrutinize fee awards very carefully because of that fiduciary role. Here, the $43.5 million in fee represents a multiplier of 6 under the reconstructed time, because they didn't keep actual time, and at least 10 under a more accurate lodestar if you take out some obvious methodological problems. It's an unprecedented fee in the Seventh Circuit, or indeed anywhere in the United States. And we complain of three errors in this appeal. The first error is that under Synthroid, which is a percentage case, it says there are three factors that go into determining a market fee: the riskiness, the ex ante riskiness of the case, the amount of work, and the results achieved. Judge Kaney and Florin, you said ex ante riskiness is the main factor that you look at. Here, the judge did not examine any of those three factors in awarding the fees. The record showed that as to riskiness, compared with most class actions, this was a very low risk, time at risk, because they knew from the two prior cases on COLAs that, just like this case, the Cole and the Lorenzano case, which they litigated and won, that you could file a cross motion for liability at the outset of the case. It was a 15-page motion. And win or lose, they knew whether the case had legs. They knew this was a stipulated factual record. It required one short deposition of a records custodian, 300 total pages of documents produced, very little use of experts, a stipulated damage amount, a stipulated class. This is very different in terms of the time that you put at risk. And that's the same factor that goes into the work that's required, which Judge Barker did not analyze. As to the results achieved, our clients are paying 60% of this $43.5 million, and for the reasons Ms. Ballard articulated, we think that the result was not up to snuff. The second error that we complain about was the failure to use a lodestar cross-check. Again, Judge Kaney, you did that in Florin yourself. It was a settlement of $15.5 million. They sought a fee of $2.85 million. It was 18% of the fund and a multiplier of 1.53, which you said was appropriate. It accounted for about a 30% chance that the case would be lost. Here, Judge Barker recognized that she needed this data. It was important. And she wrote two opinions where she said, I have to have this lodestar data. In the first opinion, she said, without this information, we lack an informative measure of what constitutes a reasonable prevailing market price. This is in the record at A737. But yet, when she got that, and it showed this extraordinary multiplier over anything, this court has repeatedly said that a multiplier of 2 is a sensible ceiling. When she got this data and it showed a multiplier between 6 and 10, she didn't take any account of that in her fee opinion. The third and final, I see that I'm out of time.
Go ahead.
Thank you. The third and final error, and I'll be very brief on this, is that she put total reliance on this declaration by Mr. Slater that came into the record. They were trying to say there's no market for ERISA attorneys in the nation who would handle this case on any kind of lodestar multiplier basis, and indeed there's no market for any ERISA attorneys who would handle it except for 30%. In Florin, you had very competent 4 nationally recognized attorneys who were still in practice who did litigate that case for a multiplier of 1.53 and a lodestar amount. But instead, and she had the only one of the four declarants who was an ERISA attorney, Mr. Theodore, had just concluded a lodestar case, the West versus A.K. Steele. Instead of looking at that, she put her reliance entirely on Mr. Slater, who had litigated 2 ERISA cases in his 30-year career, and obviously could not opine about the national market for ERISA attorneys. Thank you very much.
May it please the court, Lee Freeman for the class plaintiffs. This record demonstrates a thorough and painstaking review of the issues raised by objectors by Judge Barker. To begin with, Judge Barker sat on this case for 11 years. She presided over all of the issues that came up to this court and then were remanded. And after the remand from this court's entry of judgment on liability, it was street to street, house to house fighting in the district court. You just need to review the entries on the docket sheet to show the fights over discovery, the extensive briefing that occurred before the judge. The judge was well aware of the risks in this case. Not only were they explained to the judge when the settlement was presented, but she had ruled on the statute of limitations issue, which would have wiped out the class, and she had under submission the argument that the remedy for the subsidized early retirees should be limited to the difference between the COLA enhanced normal benefit and what they received as a subsidized early retirement benefit. Her order refers to the nuts and the twists and turns, but she says in her order specifically, I have on several occasions recited the numerous risks that face the plaintiffs in this case. And if you go back and read her remarks at the hearing on the motion for preliminary approval of the settlement at Appendix 277-281 and her remarks at the fairness hearing, she catalogs exactly what was facing the plaintiffs, the risks that were facing the plaintiffs in this case. First, the court had ruled in Berger versus AXA that the date of accrual was when the plan announced they weren't giving a COLA and that the two-year state statute of limitations should apply. Judge Barker ruled that there was that by forcing Williams to exhaust his remedies, the statute of limitations extended back to the enactment of ERISA. A disturbance of that ruling on appeal would have wiped out most of the recovery by the objectors. The court was aware of the fact that Contilli and Rabarczyk had reversed Constantino. In the Sixth Circuit, Constantino was reversed by Rabarczyk. And Rabarczyk said you had to pick the plan could make you pick the greater of the two benefits. The point is that ERISA law is in flux. ERISA law has numerous twists and turns, as the judge said. And while this case was pending, Frommert was before the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court decided it, which reaffirmed this court's decision in Frye and other decisions, the Firestone doctrine of deference to the plan administrator in fashioning a remedy. So the plaintiffs faced an enormous risk when this case started, which bears on both the reasonableness of the settlement and the reasonableness of the attorney's fees awarded, because there was no way to determine whether the plaintiffs would be successful and whether they would recover the amount they recovered. Ms. Pellman's counsel said the party structured the settlement to wipe out the COLA. That the record just disproves that. The record shows that this settlement was negotiated precisely in the manner of the way the case was litigated. The parties first established a base amount for the normal retirees pursuant to this court's order. The case was then remanded to the district court for damage issues and remedial issues. And it was there, all of the briefing, all of the fighting after remand was on behalf of subsidized early retirees and people who would have otherwise been barred by the statute of limitations. And the settlement was first negotiated to get an amount for the people who were covered by this court's order, and then the council kept pushing to recover for the people who weren't covered by this court's order, where the plan had interposed arguments that they weren't entitled to a remedy. The liability was established. The plan had liability. The question was the remedy. The question was amount of damages. As Mr. LaRocca even says in his at the hearing, class counsel did a terrific job, I'm quoting, of representing the interests of both groups up through 2009. There's no basis in this record for fragmenting the class, balkanizing the class, and having separate counsel for subsidized early retirees, because their interests were the same. They simply had, they faced different arguments on remedies. But even if there were a reason, the subsidized early retirees were in fact represented by Mr. Grabhorn, who filed a case in Kentucky, who participated in the mediation before Magistrate Judge Hausman, and who stood up at the final, who filed affidavits on behalf of his clients Allen and Colston, and stood up when asked by Judge Barker at the fairness hearing whether he approved of the settlement. He said yes, he had studied it, he had looked at it, he had been informed, and he approved of the settlement. And so, in fact, there was a representative. Counsel also claimed that there was no appraisal, no notice of the strengths of the claim. Mr. McGill will address that, but the class notice did, in fact, say the range of recovery was estimated to between one-third of the $180 million and somewhat north of twice of $180 million. So it was explained to the judge at the time of the motion for preliminary approval of the hearing, and it was included in the class notice. In terms of the attorney's fees, I think the case that most closely controls this one is Taubenfeld, which is the most recent case applying the Synthroid factors. There's also Montgomery versus Aetna Plywood. But Taubenfeld controls for two reasons, in that Taubenfeld follows the Synthroid analysis that you look ex ante to what the market would be for counsel to handle a case of this magnitude and with this risk. But in Taubenfeld, the court also held that the objector had waived the objections. And on page 16 of our brief, we quote the fairness hearing at which Judge Barker specifically asked Mr. LaRocca, give me the head notes. Are you contending that there should be a lodestar analysis here? He says, no, I'm not contending that. I'm contending you have to look at Synthroid, and Synthroid doesn't justify. He says, the bottom line, it's not a market rate for the reasons in Synthroid, and I quote. The evidence here was uncontroverted and overwhelming. You had the affidavit of Mr. Strong, Mr. Price, Mr. Theodo, Mr. Sussman, and Mr. Slater, who the judge quotes in her order, explaining that no one would take this case at anything less than 30%, 33%. But even beyond that, and as we quote as we make reference on page 30 of our brief, Mr. LaRocca was one of the counsel in Synthroid. And in Synthroid, he presented to this court evidence of market rate. He presented the affidavit of Professor Coffey, John Coffey, the famous John Coffey, the affidavit of Judge Arlen Adams, and the affidavit of Harry Reisner, of Vincent and Elkins, and all these affidavits, which he put into evidence in Synthroid, stated that the market rate for these kinds of lawyers was over 30%, was more than 30% for these kind of cases, for a competent lawyer for these kind of cases. And Mr. Reisner's affidavit referred to the fact that his firm had received a 33 1/3% fee in a $634 million recovery. To me, it's irresponsible to stand before this court and claim that the market is anything else. But beyond that, there was no evidence, as the judge said. There was some anecdotal remarks about past fee awards, such as you heard today, but there was no evidence. There was no evidence disputing these affiants. There was no attempt to go behind what they said and see whether, in fact, what they said was accurate, because what they said was accurate. There was no way to contest their affidavits, and they didn't.
Is this a national rate as opposed to regional?
Yes, it's a national market and a national rate, Your Honor. And as the affiants make clear, and as I think if you look through the cases, you'll see there aren't that many people who are really good at doing this, and they lose. It's risky. We've gone to trial in two cases, Berger and Cooper. We lost Cooper up on appeal. When we think we have a good case, we go to trial. You have experienced lawyers here who have done this all over the country. And I should mention that the same lawyers handled Lorenzano and Cole, which Mr. LaRocca referred to. But in Lorenzano, there was no issue of subsidized early retirement benefits, so it really doesn't control. I know it's not it's not up on a. It hasn't been appealed. The objectors who objected to the allocation that the judge found very creative in terms of the difference in statute of limitations risks, because some people had retired so long ago. If that hasn't been appealed, but if there were a reversal, this 1% of the class is putting at risk 99% of the class that recovers, because that would be a critical, significant issue that the plan would raise if in fact the case were sent back to the district court. I think the final word I have is that this offset argument, this argument that somehow one benefit was used to wipe out another benefit is a total red herring, because as I said, it begs the issue. As I said, the settlement proceeded with what this court had ruled, and then to establish liability and to establish damages and remedies for the people who weren't covered by this court's first opinion, and there was absolutely no trade-offs. And there was no discussion. The record also shows there's no discussion of attorney's fees in any of these negotiations. After the negotiations were through, we told the plans counsel that we would seek attorney's fees in the amount of that was requested and awarded. One final issue, though it wasn't raised by counsel here, was the 2.3 obliquely the stipulated 2.32 COLA, that wasn't reduced. That 2.3 attorney's fees were awarded, which mathematically would have reduced it to 1.63. But that 2. What's interesting is the 2.32, 1.63 issue applies only to the normal retirees with the COLA. It doesn't apply to the subsidized early retirees. So as Mr. LaRocca notes in his brief, if you raise the COLA, you would reduce the amount of money allocated to the subsidized early retirees. And Judge Barker recognized that, and what she said at the hearing before she made her remarks about the COLA, she said the $180 million settlement, the compromise, the fact that this was a compromise, drives the 1.63. It's just a reflection of the compromise that was made. We submit the case. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Counsel. Mr. McHill.
Good Good morning. May it please the Court. I'm Robert McGill. I represent the plan in this case, and I wanted to perhaps start with where Judge Barker directed the parties to issue a class notice and to provide specific details about what was before the class as they decided what to do in relation to the settlement. And here's what the Court directed be said and what was said in the class notice itself. Depending on how the district court and any appeals court may have ruled on the unresolved issues, the settlement value represents a recovery of more than three times the smallest amount of damages the plan may have owed, or alternatively, slightly less than half of the largest amount of damages the plaintiff might have owed if the class prevailed on all of the remaining issues in the district court and in any appeal. The court directed that those particular words because the district court understood and appreciated, based on 8 years of observation, 8 years of active litigation and observations related to that proceeding in her court, that there were unresolved issues and they were significant. What were they? First, and by the way, she incorporated the terms of that notice and the very words that she directed us, the parties, to give to the plaintiffs, all of them, as a part of her final order, and incorporated that at paragraph 8, page 15 of her final order. But what were the issues, or in her words, what were the unresolved issues as she described them? Well, there was a statute of limitations issue, and it was a significant issue from the standpoint of jurisprudence as it existed at the time and today. The issue was which statute of limitation applied as a matter of the law. Was it Pennsylvania, 4 years, or was it Indiana, 10 years, based on a written contract? Well, not only was there a question of which state's law would apply on the statute of limitations, as she knew, but there was a critical accrual of the action principle that had to be vindicated and resolved. And what she found is that the statute of limitations began to run once the administrative remedies were exhausted. There was a question, there is a question, there was at the time, and perhaps there is today, in terms of a clear repudiation doctrine of accrual. Did that apply or not? Certainly your plan felt that that clear repudiation occurred at the time of the summary plan description being issued in 1994. If that were the case, and if this court decided that the clear repudiation doctrine would apply and that the summary plan description was the operative trigger, then most all, or virtually all, of the class plaintiffs would be out of court on a statute of limitations issue. There could have been a separate accrual analysis that this court could have made on appeal to decide that the payment date instead was the trigger and the accrual date that it would occur under the circumstances. That was an unresolved issue. She resolved it in the first instance. She knew, the court knew, the district court knew that this court would have the final say. So did we. So did the class counsel. What other unresolved issue was there? The Section 1054 C3 issue, and that question specifically of what was your plan to do after the directive by this court to calculate COLA? What were we to do? That was the directive, the order you gave in the first appeal. Well, that's not such an easy question, and the district court appreciated that, because what that meant your plan had to do was resort to Section 1054 C3 and its language and make a decision. What was the net payment, if any, due under those circumstances? Not an easy question. In the fact, there's no decisional law in the country that we're aware of on the point. The plan could have decided, it didn't, it could have decided that it was to net the payment out in a way that there was a proper adjustment, which under certain circumstances and on certain terms and conditions could have taken many of the plaintiffs out of any recovery here. Again, an unresolved issue. So what does that mean here? What that means here is your district court exercised discretion. The class counsel had a responsibility to every one of the class members, and they will tell you, and by our observation, they discharged it. We had a responsibility to the plan, and our responsibility was to assess those litigation risks, and we did. And as we did our work, and as the class counsel did their work, it was time for the district court, and the district court did its work. She's entitled to a high deference on review here. She had 8 years of observation to inform her judgment. She made her judgment and exercised her sound discretion based on 8 years of litigation. We ask that this court affirm that discretion by your district court here and affirm the order and approve in all respects the order that the district court entered. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. McGill. Ballard? How much time does Mr. Ballard have? 3 minutes.
Let me first correct something that I said in my opening. I said the early retirees were getting $60,000 out of 300, and I meant $60 million out of $300 million. Let me just address a couple of these points. First, Mr. Freeman said that this court's order on appeal, the last appeal, only applied to the regular retirees. And that just isn't true. The order applied to all lump sum retirees. There was no distinction made between the regular retirees and the early retirees. There was no distinction made in any of the arguments to this court between those two groups, and there was no separate defense to payment raised by the plan at that time. And this goes to the other issue that both appellees have raised, which is the judge had 9 years to evaluate this case. True, but she didn't have 9 years to consider the early retirees issue because it didn't come up at all until after the Supreme Court denied cert. It was at the remedies phase that the plan first said, okay, we lost for everybody. And they said in their cert petition, we're going to have to pay a COLA for everybody, and it's not going to be able to be cut back. We lost for everybody, but we only have to give a remedy to 65% of the class, not to the 45% who retired early. And the court didn't have 9 years to consider this. This was simply not dealt with at all until the remedies phase. Yes, it was briefed, but there was no decision made about it. So it came up at the last minute. It was the plan's fifth argument about why they didn't have to pay a COLA in the case, and it had never been raised before. In response to Appelli's point about how there were risks, serious risks in the case, particularly from the statute of limitations issue, well, there are risks, but the cost of bearing all of those risks has been placed on the early retirees. The statute of limitations risk has only been basically put on the risk of that is only being paid for by the early old retirees, the retirees who may have retired before the statute of limitations, in the sense that they're getting a lower prejudgment interest. They're still getting full value for their COLAs. They're just getting a lower prejudgment interest. It's the early retirees who are being cut from full value to 20% of full value, and only the early retirees. So there's really no reason why they should bear the cost of all of these risks. One other issue, Mr. Freeman said that the Costantino case has now been reversed by the Rybarczyk case. And yes, Costantino is a very strong argument in favor of the early retirees' full recovery. Rybarczyk, in fact, only concerns prospective amendments to a plan. It still says that with regard to the retrospective amendments, the retroactive amendments, that the principles of Costantino must be observed. Thank you.
Thank you, Councilman.
That's it.
All right. Thanks to all counsel. The case will be taken under advisement and removed to the